Any acquisition is considerable effort. It usually takes at least 2-3 months to have 2-3 businesses to which we can progress with and have some engaging conversation. And you are at a stage where you are reviewing financial information, management accounts, P&Ls, client business structure, perhaps having 1 or 2 site visit or face-to-face meetings. And if you have like 3 businesses into this stage of progressing, you can maybe close one within the next 2-3 months.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I'm going to refer back to a couple of podcasts we've done, episode 81 with Ben Meakey and episode 66 with Aristides Zervas. Ben is a fractional CFO, and he does a really good job of selling one of the great superpowers of what a CFO can do, and that's around transactions. They're able to manage an acquisition project like no one else, basically. They have that unique skill set. And he just believes that firmly that CFOs, if you hire a really top-class CFO, it's something that can be very transformational in your business. Aristides, in episode 66, he worked doing exactly this, rolling up escalator companies in Europe. They were a manufacturing company, and they started to acquire their service providers in different countries. And he's also managed to massively grow his business using this exact strategy. So I needed to find someone who could come along and go deeper on, doing a roll-up, doing a merger, acquisitions, it's a good strategy. But can we learn a bit more about that today? And for that purpose, I have invited along a video. It's just Milno from Chelsea Corporate. You're a buy-side broker. So maybe you could just introduce yourself to the guests, tell us a bit about yourself and your background and some of the things you've done, and then we'll dig into how to actually run an acquisition strategy as a CFO.
Background about myself, I've always been passionate about entrepreneurship, and I've owned various businesses in different sectors and work with international clients on the expansion of those businesses, which I've exited a couple of times. Last business portfolio was in the HoReCa industry, hospitality, chain of restaurants and cafes, which we struggled through COVID and then surfaced and turned it around and sold it right after COVID. And then joined forces with Chelsea Corporate, a buy-side advisory firm headquartered in London. I'm handling the Bucharest division of the company. And I'm just following my passion into essentially buying and selling businesses. And we work closely with clients that are looking to do acquisitions for their own purposes, either to tap into a new market or expand their business geographically, or just building a group of businesses for a later exit. Actually, our expertise and our core expertise is finding those businesses that are not actively looking to sell. They're not published on the market. Those are the best businesses to acquire. And that is when they reach us.
You touched on there that you've actually, your experience comes from being an operator. Sounds like you were in the hospitality sector, in the hotel industry.
I had a few businesses. I had a few restaurants, which I sold. I bought them when their profits were very low and turned them around, upscaled the profits, and then sold them. I own actually a few Airbnb businesses. So I built a group of flats, flat portfolio, rent it on Airbnb, and then sell it as a business. I own an e-commerce business, being solid distributor, importer and distributor for some bio-cosmetic products from Greece. Built that and sold it. I own a few beauty saloons, some nightclubs, a tourism local agency where we built some tourist packages and we sold them to the international tourist agencies, built that for about 3 years and successfully sold it. I think there might be a few more, but I don't remember them now.
A true entrepreneur then. And what was your typical holding period for each of those businesses?
Minimum 3 years.
Minimum 3, yeah. Okay. So pretty rapid still to turn around a business 3 years, buy it and sell it. Still pretty high tempo.
You know, there are different ways of investing in businesses, right? Instead of flipping real estate, you flip businesses. It's kind of the same idea. But there are multiple ways of doing it. So you either come in a distressed business, a business that is loss-making money, where you know that you can leverage your knowledge, your experience, turn it around into profits, and then sell it. Either you go in at a higher level with businesses that already are profitable, they already hold a good second tier management, so they will not require your day-to-day involvement in the operations. And you can only focus on the expansion, sales, cost adjustments of the business, which essentially can take only a few hours, some calls throughout your connection world, and drive growth in that business, adjusting costs, upscaling sales, basically driving for growth in the EBITDA.
That's interesting to start off with. I mean, as a newbie to this, I would have said, oh, I want to look for a poorly managed business so that there are easy wins. It sounds like this is something maybe you did with the restaurant businesses. How was your strategy back then, looking for something that was obviously could be improved? You grew from that. You were like, no, that's doing it on hard mode. It's actually much better to have a great business.
Well, I started there because the finances weren't great, right? So
right.
Whenever you have some, you know, finance on the side, you don't want to risk it all. Yeah, you want to risk about 20-30% of it, right? So you have to go within that budget. So I look at what do I know how to do good? I can flip it pretty fast, so I don't get involved too much. And I found a few restaurants that were nice places, looking very nice. So they were not requesting my financial investment into renovation, which is a hard investment. It will require my investment in turning around the services, turning around the menu, and bringing in clients. This is not really that financially expensive to turn around. So I changed the staff, and in restaurants, you know, staffs are paid on a minimum wage because they do tips. So the wages are fairly low. And then I changed the service. I trained the staff and I teach them how to handle clients and how to handle service so we can get recommendation, right? And then first thing that I did, I brought all my friends and relatives into my place, into my restaurants, so they can spread the word of mouth into their circle. And we managed to grow like that pretty fast.
Sounds like you've done very well in that. You had probably had a choice of many things you could have done, but you decided to make the actual flipping part, let's not call it flipping, let's call it search part, finding the opportunities, your business. Why do that? Why not go on to bigger restaurants and flashier locations and bigger hotels? Why did you go the way you went?
I think first reason was financial. So it only required a small financial investment on my side. It was more work to it than financial.
Right.
That was the first choice. Second choice, hospitality was only my passion. I always had some restaurants or cafe as a side business. It's like a passionate thing, right? Is that, or I go fishing or whatever. And it's something that it was easy for me to do. As on the side, I was doing real estate as well. Real estate is another side business that I always do. But it's not as profitable as flipping a business. Flipping a business can be much more profitable with much less investment than real estate. It went well together.
I worked in London helping my brother-in-law, starting a burrito chain in London at Lunch Place. We did it for a summer. We worked for nothing. I never worked so hard in my life. In fact, that's how I only got my real first business going, because I decided, wow, that's real work. I don't want to have to do that. So I went and actually did what it took to make the other business work, having seen what restaurateurs do. You know, it's insane. And you know what blows my mind? You mentioned the minimum wage people. Even the head chef at our place was almost minimum wage, but the level of expertise and actually logistical know-how in making a restaurant, you know, using the right amount of food, not ordering too much, getting the right amount, it's like way above what most white collar workers are expected to do, you know?
I always paid my chefs well. So the chefs and the cooks, the sous chefs, were paid well, because there is two things driving in a restaurant business: service and quality of food. If you don't have those, you can close it immediately. It doesn't really matter how nice is inside or how worse is inside. If your food is good and your service is good, people will always come back to you. So I paid my chefs pretty well. So let's say when the minimum wage was about 400 euros, my chefs were making 2000.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. So you got the top 10%.
But he was handling, you know, everything related to food. He was handling the recipes. He was handling the orders, the suppliers. He was handling reception of the merchandise coming into the restaurant, everything.
All right. Well, I feel like we could talk about that for an hour at least,
yeah,
but people aren't here for that. Let's start with what you are, which is a buy-side broker. So maybe you could just explain exactly what that is and how does it compare to a sell-side broker?
Well, essentially, buy-side broker, we are working directly for the client or the person or the business who's looking to acquire another business, and they delegate us to find that business for them. We are not reaching out to the buyers. They are reaching out to us. So it's a business where it goes by your name. If you have a good reputation and you deliver a good service, then your clients will recommend you to his friend who wants to extend his business, and he will come on to you. So in that spectrum, it's a very good business because we've been in the market for so long. M&A market was really challenging in the past years, and we managed to stay at the same turnover level. So even though if in the UK, if the market lost like 40% of the transaction value overall, we managed to turn over the same revenue, which is very, very good. And with buy side, it really comes like a tailored service in a business acquisition. So, you know, the client gives us a brief of what he's looking for, but many times even the client is not really sure on what he's looking for, right? He wants to do something. He wants to do an acquisition. He kind of knows what he wants, but he doesn't. So it's really a process where, you know, if you sign in with us today, we go look for a business for you according to your brief, but we will already understand exactly what you're looking to achieve after we only had 4 or 5 calls with potential sellers. Then we can understand the more scope of your achievement. As opposed to a sell side, if you want, where sell side are working, you know, calling everyday businesses, hey, do you want me to sell your business? And they calling all these business owners, and then they say, you know, we can take your business, put it in a very nice frame, do some very good presentation, put it in the market, attract some buyers, and then you will pay us in the beginning a few thousands or tens of thousands for the presentation, and then you're going to pay us another success fee when we sell the business, if we sell it the business.
The market isn't liquid enough. You really never know which businesses are truly for sale, right? So the buy side guy or the sell side guy is just going to be putting you up on a website somewhere, maybe approaching a couple of investment firms.
Yeah, what they usually do, so like they do have a list of private equities that they work with or investment offices or something like that, right? And whenever they land a business in, they send it to that. If that's not going to catch any attraction or any interested buyer, then what they do, they take your business, create a teaser with some information of the business, but not specifics. So the buyer won't identify the business, right? And put it on the internet, on the free web for everybody to see and list it like an apartment. Essentially, yeah, put it on all this website and you're going to see your business for sale everywhere. And that can be very damaging for the business, because if you have a few half a month, you know, 6 months to a year, and your business is not sold, then all the buyers in the market will raise red flags. Why is not sold? If that was a good business, it would have been sold.
Let's imagine you're a newly hired CFO in a company. You've come in, you've identified that they maybe have the cash or the ability to raise debt to do an acquisition. They've decided, okay, this is something I'm interested in doing. So you're typically working with operators of companies which have a growth through acquisition strategy, but just maybe don't have the time to go searching for themselves. Or do you work with like family offices or investment firms? Is it more on the commercial side or are on the investment side do you work?
I will say the spread is about 70 to 30%. So 70% are business owners that are looking to expand their business, either geographically or just workforce and client base and things like that. And the rest are private equities, investment offices, funds.
Okay, so you're a CFO working in a commercial entity normally. You've decided acquisitions is something you need to look at, but you've got a blank sheet. What are the nuts and bolts? What do you do on Monday morning to put a process in place to go about finding potential targets?
As a CFO, I guess you don't really have too many tools if you don't know them. You scatter the online market and see whatever businesses are available for sale and take it up from there. Us, we are using a bunch of tools. One of them is Sales Navigator with LinkedIn, which is a business tool to find business owners. Another one is PitchBook. PitchBook is a software that qualifies businesses that are interested in selling, but they're not on the market. And there are a couple of other tools, but not really that good. I think PitchBook and Sales Navigator are the best, but they're pretty expensive. So if you don't do that on a daily basis, it's kind of expensive to just to try and search for a month or two. The one that we use, it's a tool that we developed internally. It's an AI search tool. that we developed in the past years based on our experience and based on the minuses that we identified in the best tool that we used. So we built this tool, and now essentially we go in and we tell this tool what we want, and he is scattering the world and give us a list. That list is getting fine-tuned by our junior team according to my brief. I give them a brief and they fine-tune all the businesses. And they come up with a list based on the most ticking points that it takes for the buyer to the less. And then I start and approach the decision makers directly.
So this sounds familiar to me as someone who's run outbound sales campaigns. And I guess if you have an outbound sales team in your company, you could repurpose them and try and do this yourself. Of course, it would be the first time they'd be doing that. So what does your ideal buyer or ideal seller in this case, I guess, look like? I guess it's got to have some financial metrics in there. Are we looking at the age profile of the owner?
I don't think there is ideal. For us, for example, every client that signs in, they'll have to provide us with proof of funds related to the size of the acquisition that they want to do, just to make sure, you know, they can afford to do the acquisition. Because first of all, we don't want to work for nothing. And second of all, if we are turning a good business into a potential seller, we don't want to ruin our name in front of the seller and put them in front of a buyer that cannot do it. And we do also help the buyer with our collaborators in terms of financing. So we do have some good finance guys that can help finance the acquisition and leverage either the assets of the acquired business or the debtor book of the acquired business. And, you know, if you want to buy a business that, let's say it's a valuation for 5 million, you can raise between 2 to 4 million in funding for that acquisition. You only need 1 million if you want to do it. But you got to have the tools and know the people.
You might have your own banking relationships, or again, you've obviously done it dozens of times. So.
Banking, no. We're not using. The banks are the most awful thing you want to use, because it will take them 3 months to respond to your request, and it will respond with no. You don't want to use facts.
Okay, all right.
We use private lenders. Usually, yeah, the interest is a bit higher, but things are going better, and the numbers have to work, of course.
I don't normally have an opportunity to talk about something I know about in this podcast, but when it comes to when I'm thinking a campaign like this, I'm thinking, let's talk numbers. Like, if I'm running an outbound campaign, I know, okay, I might need, let's say, 1,000 prospects to get 100 people to reply to me to get like 10, 20, you know, meetings, etc. Do you set a target like that? Do you say, listen, I think for this type of company, we're going to need to take 3 months. It's going to need to be doing like 40 dials a day. How do you architect how much effort you think you're going to need to put in to find a suitable acquisition?
Any acquisition is considerable of effort. It's a matter of luck if you're going to find it within a week or two. That's what we call them slaps, right? You're going to slap it if you're going to find it in a week or two. It usually takes at least 2-3 months to have 2-3 businesses to which we can progress with and have some engaging conversation. And you are at a stage where you are reviewing financial information, management accounts, P&Ls, client business structure, perhaps having 1 or 2 sites visit or face-to-face meetings. And if you have like 3 businesses into this stage of progressing, you can maybe close one within the next 2-3 months.
What size of team do you need to do this properly? You need 1 person, 2 person, 4 people. What do you typically need in terms of manpower to make sure you're doing a proper search?
Well, myself, I'm using 3 people, and essentially they do the research strategy according to what they say, what I give them as a brief, and they put up the target list. So for now, we are working with a client that is looking for a healthcare-related business, right? It doesn't matter if it's like a clinic or a recruitment to healthcare or whatever. So we have identified about 6,000 potential targets.
Right.
Now, those 6,000, we need to narrow it within a few hundreds. And those 200, we need to narrow it in a few tens. And when we get to 40, 50 targets, then I engage myself.
So this is weird. I mean, you get a phone call from someone saying, hey, I've got someone who wants to give you a lot of money for your business, but you can't say it's too much or else the deal's not going to happen. There must be a temptation to oversell at the beginning to try and get them up the pipeline.
The hardest thing is actually to have them listening to you the first 20 seconds, because they are abused with this cold calling, mainly from the sell side broker. Now, it may not sound nice, but they are doing us a favor in that term, because sell side brokers are calling them to sell them their service. If you get them to listen to you for the first 20 seconds, until the point where you reach, we are retained by our client and you don't have any financial obligation with us in case of a deal, then you got their attention because, okay, you're not calling me to ask me money. We build a professional profile to each of our clients, a bit of his background, his business experience, about his business a little bit. And we start feeding the potential seller bits of information about our client, but we are not revealing his name. And if they will want to reveal his name, then they have an obligation to go into a call with us. And by going into a call with us, they have to sign an NDA with the client, at which point he will see the name of the client. And then he can make a more educated decision. But I think the first 20 seconds of that call are crucial. If you don't get hanged up in that those 20 seconds, you're good.
So I'm hearing there's a lot of dialing going on in these campaigns. It's old school getting people on the phone.
Cold calling is still one of the tools. Now I think it's the less responsive one. So my personal approach is on social media. So I have my junior team building a social media profile for every client, for every potential seller. And then I approach them on the social networks, because on the social network, the guy can actually see your face. And that is a very big impact as opposed to a voice on the call. So when I send them a message on the social media, I'm not sending them a selling message. This is a mistake. However you formulate it, it is still a sell message and you don't want to get that across, right? So I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a broker. I would just like to discuss with you business synergies. Maybe we can do something with your business. And that can flow into his mind into many ways.
So I've heard a mix there. There's calling, there's, you know, attracting people on social media, there's directly approaching them. You get to that first call, they've signed an NDA. Where do you go from there? Because if you burn the boats and bring too many dud prospects to your client, that's not going to work. So how do you handle the delicate negotiation between deciding whether they're right, figuring that out, trying to encourage them, but not encourage them to give them the wrong idea? Because ultimately, I guess this is what they call proprietary deal flow, right? So you want to be the only buyer. You don't want to be competing against six others. So you can't get them too excited about the opportunity. How do you handle that first call?
Well, the first call with the seller is directly with me, is not with the buyer. So it's me and the seller. And many of the sellers have not gone through this process, M&A process. They don't know, you know, what's going to happen. So the first thing I do, I give them a guide throughout how the things are supposed to happen, because all of them are telling me, you know, sell side brokers are calling me on a daily basis. So then I give them like a free advice and a free consultancy, 30 minutes consultancy, on how the process is actually run. And I also give them a brief information about the sell side broker, how they are operating, and what will mean for them to work with the sell side broker as opposed to working with me, which I'm not going to fish for clients with his business. So, and then I'll tell them, you know, of course my client had viewed your business and he likes it, but in order to have a meaningful conversation with him, I will need to get some details so we can fact check some of the financial information. And then you get like turnover, EBITDA, number of employees, a few bits of information about his clients and his market and so on. And then you move to having an introductory call with your client after you have this information, so you can go into more profound discussion on the call. But usually the first call, it's about synergies, because if the two of them as individual doesn't connect, you don't have anything. That's the main core of the first call. If they like themselves as individual, both of them, they will open to each other a lot. And from there, it's easier.
Let's say you get to the stage where, yes, everything on paper looks good. What tips do you have for actually getting the deal over the line? Because many deals can look good and then fizzle for whatever reason. So what do you do at that stage to make sure it happens?
The first tip that I have, and I always tell my clients, be ready to be engaged with them. I think momentum, it's creating the deal, and time is what is killing the deal. If we spoke to the guy today, we're not going to let it a week, 10 days until we reach out to him again, because it's going to go cold. He's going to have his wife, daughter, son, whatever, talking at his ear, and things are going to go bust. So just to give you an example, right? A client of mine made an offer for an acquisition. The seller got back with the counter structure of the deal. So the overall valuation was accepted, but the deal structure wanted to be different, right? The seller sent the email to my client last Tuesday, and I was talking to my client yesterday because I was CC'd in the thread, and I looked and I said, did you reply to the seller? I said, oh, I'm still thinking to get back with the counter structure to him. I said, just reply to the guy, tell him, thank you very much. I received this, I'm considering it, and I'll get back to you within a few days with the counter structure. Otherwise, you're going to lose it. And that's the most important thing. Keep up the momentum and keep them warm, as I like to say.
So let's talk about industries then. I mean, the types and scale of businesses that you help in particular. Like, who's the ideal type of business that you would be a perfect customer for you?
In terms of sector, I think one of the easiest ones to trade, I think, are the regulatory businesses, right? So if you're talking financial services, accountancy practices, law offices, because the buyers are from the same segment always, and they speak the same language, and the due diligence process is fairly easy, right? When you have like a different buyer, let's say private equity or a family office that is buying a business just because the numbers are right and it doesn't know anything about the sector, but you know, the business has a second tier management, is running well, doesn't need their involvement, they cannot connect with the seller at the same level where you speak the same language. So that's challenging, and that is where we actually come in during the call and make the seller feel comfortable that actually our buyer kind of knowing what it's doing, even if it's not.
It's dead right. When any time I've sort of talked with other companies who are looking to acquire, you do feel like, especially in the investment banking side, you just feel private equity, it's just a total different world.
Yes. Yeah.
Oftentimes dealing with people at different experience levels at different stages of the process. I've experienced this myself. They come in and seem to tend to know a lot about your business, but how could they? They've never run a business like this.
Exactly. They never run it from the ground up. They know it at an executive role, right? But operational, they know nothing about it. And in today's world, a lot of these businesses owners that have grown their business from scratch and they put their sweat and tear into it, they don't want private equity buyers. They want a genuine individual, somebody that is from that sector or related sector that wants to grow the business or something like that. Because financial buyers are coming in, they buy you out, they give you money, they don't really care what you do. You don't have any help or support from them in running the business or anything like that. They just look at, okay, what cost can we cut and how can we raise the EBITDA so we can exit in 3-5 years and make our margin. That's their only focus. When the business owners that, you know, have grown their businesses for 10, 15, 20 years, they want to see their legacy moving forward.
And listen, they might be interested in a 3-5 year exit, and that could fit for them, but not for everyone, right? Especially those businesses that's been around 20 years. There's a lot of baggage, a lot of customers and staff.
I'm selling a business now where the business owner is not 100% acquisition, it's 70%. But the business owner wants the PE out of his business. He doesn't want them as partners anymore. He wants to take them out. So he's looking for another buyer to get the PE out. Because it's just no support from them. It's just report, you know, report every month, report every 2 months, and that's it. You want to see results, but you're not giving anything in between. What's the purpose? I'm working for you in my business, right?
So listen, how can people reach out to you? What's the best way to connect with you if they want to work with you or find out more about what you do?
They can simply send me a message on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active there. Or they can call our offices at Chelsea Corporate and ask to speak with me. I'm pretty easy to reach. And I do reply personally to my social media profiles.
Okay, well, include your link if you're watching on YouTube below, so you can get that right below this video. And then I have a traditional question I'd like to wrap up the podcast here, which is around business heroes. So who would top your list as a business hero today?
I think Richard Branson and Elon Musk as top entrepreneurs, because they're mind-spoken. They really don't bend for business, if you know what I mean. Richard Branson, you know, is not a highly educated guy, but he got himself educated through business and he made a lot of money with but one type of business. But now he holds various businesses and he's pretty smart to see a gap in an industry and go for that gap. And the way he drives success is actually employing the best experts in the sector and bring them in their business, is recruiting them from the competition, paying them more, bring them in the business. And he gets a lot of knowledge for that spending. With Elon, I like about him because he's an innovator and he's always see things to bring in. But I also think of himself, you know, he really knows that he's a very good and very smart. And this sometimes is like a two-way sword. And he's underestimating his possible competition in some ways.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. When you pick a hero like that, you're saying a lot, not just about what they achieve, but who they are. I mean, Richard Branson's lifestyle, a lot of people would envy, with islands and helicopters and airplanes and so on. Elon Musk, his lifestyle, not so much.
Yeah, true. But, you know, planes and helicopters and islands and yachts, it's a lifestyle for every billionaire. They all have it. It's nothing new to anybody. But they are not all enjoying it. I know if you've seen Elon Musk in his swimming shorts lately. That guy is white. He never saw sun for 10 years. I mean, you know, what's the point of working and working and working if you're not going to enjoy life a little bit?
If you've got this far into the podcast, I really appreciate you listening. If you're an operator and you have experience with buying and selling businesses, I'd love to hear from you to come online. Maybe you've sold a business, maybe you've been acquired, maybe you've been on the other side. I'd love to talk through that experience with you to maybe share with the audience and see if we can get some benefit from it. Video, you've been a star. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, James, and all the best.